very special coax, and it worked well. But I found that I need more turns for a little more gain to get the area. And then I have a sniffer probe, which is a Tektronix old probe that I put a little link on it at the end. And that's almost exactly what you're talking about. Plus, I have the ability of going from 1 to times 10 on it. And that works extremely well also. And you're right, I can narrow it down to almost a circuit trace. So they work very well. And this type, the flat thin one like I built here, allows me to get in between components and little transformer shields and things like that. So it's useful.
The single loop on the end of a piece of skinny coax gives you the maximum response where the loop is approximately one wavelength in circumference. And it falls off pretty fast after that. Throughout most of the frequency region, it's falling off 6 dB per octave as you go down in frequency. And yes, you've got the right idea. You could make the loop multiple turns and bring it something back up again. And your technique is another nice way to go. The thing that people like about the single loop is that the exact antenna pattern is very well known. If you're using sensitive enough instrumentation, like a spectrum analyzer, which in some cases, as long as you know the exact frequency you're looking for, you could look down at minus 130 dBm and get a display on the screen. So the fact that the loop is insensitive with the right kind of instrumentation is not a bad point. The fact that the loop has such a small effective capture area means that as you slide it across, say, for instance, the seal of the door of a microwave oven, you can find the exact nearest quarter of an inch where the leakage is coming from, if you know what I mean. So the loop I'm talking about is more of a VHF circuit. I think yours work down below VHF into the HF region and still give you a pretty good response. Is that part of what you do on that one, John? Like you might be troubleshooting in an IF strip? Over to you, KQRIW.
Yes, absolutely. The one that you're looking at goes from 110 megahertz down to 36, and it has 7 points at which it is extremely resonant, and works very well for me. I like it, and that's why I made a whole bunch of them. Also, of course, as the frequency gets higher, when I'm using my 7 to 14 gigahertz generators, I could use a pencil dish.
Would you believe I made a contact on Morse code with a guy 10 miles away, and he was transmitting through the center pin of a male SMA connector on the end of a piece of coax cable, and he was transmitting something like 1 milliwatt, 5 milliwatts, it was in that order. He was 5 milliwatts was coming out of a SMA connector, a semi-rigid cable that went nowhere, in his backyard, down at eye level, on top of a wooden ladder, is where it was located. He was 10 miles away from me through a whole lot of trees. And with my 2-foot dish on top of the 100-foot tower aimed at him, I found that signal. I could tell him over the 2-meter link, put your finger over the end of the SMA connector, and I would watch the signal go up and down in amplitude. So I was using an antenna. You could say the exposed center conductor was about an eighth of an inch long, maybe 3/32. Let's call it eighth of an inch long. So the antenna was almost in a shielded structure, the SMA male end of a cable. Eighth of an inch long antenna, milliwatts of power, 10 miles away, and I could play that signal back to him. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Now, was the SMA pointing straight up, so radially you were getting that, or was it pointed at you, sort of like a horn? I wonder.
When he plugged it into a parabolic dish, and I squirted a signal toward him from 10 miles away, and now he's in the backyard with a 3-degree, 4-degree beamless dish, and he's aiming it around the yard to find out where the signal was strongest. When he aimed at the top of the trees in his backyard, I was west of him. when he aims to the top of the trees that were to the west of him, that's where he got the strongest signal. So my signal was skipping across the top of the trees, getting to the tips of the trees in his backyard, bending down into the yard. That's how it was getting there. This whole experiment happened because he forgot to turn off some portion of his electronics while he was opening up connectors. And he had disconnected something, and I said, hey, Bruce, I'm hearing your signal. What the hell are you doing? And he started describing it to me, and we started doing this investigation. And then later, with the dish in the backyard, with a three-degree beam with him, went sniffing around, find out how was it getting there. We assumed up till then the signal was getting there by sifting through the trees. It was going across the top of the trees and then down at a 45-degree angle into the backyard, deflecting. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
I don't know. Propagation is amazing. It's just, there's, you would never think, if you wanted to design that, you'd be in the nut house by the time you figured it out. But you just, you know, you accidents, you find these things. It's just great that you picked it up and caught on to it. Amazing. From an SMA connector, I wouldn't think that would transmit 10 feet, never mind 10 miles. Oh, and by the way, Dick, I recommend Sniffers to anybody working with network analyzers, spectrum analyzers, because the input attenuation is so sensitive. Look at your signal, see what you're dealing with first before you connect this stuff, because you never know. You blow them open in no time. I'm sure you've seen that happen.
Yeah, you got to be careful with a network analyzer, spectrum analyzer, when you've got relatively strong signals. The front panel connector of a spectrum analyzer, back in the old days when you really had a turret step attenuator in 10 dB steps, and you could dial in 0, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 decibels. When you were down to the most sensitive region, 0 dB on the step attenuator on the front end, and you're on the lowest band, the 0 to 2 gig band, what happens is now the center pin of that connector on the front panel goes straight into the very first mixer. And if you're foolish enough to do anything for a microsecond, if you put more than 1.0 volts into that center conductor. In other words, you might have a piece of cable coming out of there with a series capacitor on the center conductor and a sharp probe on the end of that disc ceramic capacitor, and you're touching various circuits, and you're doing sniffing with that. And because you've got a disc ceramic capacitor, because you're capacitively decoupled, you assume you're putting no DC voltage into the spectrum analyzer. Well, not really. If you suddenly connect to something that's got 5 volts on it, and the capacitor was uncharged, instantaneously you're putting a rising spike of 5 volts into the front end. And if you do that for more than some number of nanoseconds, you have just damaged that first mixer. And on many spectrum analyzers, that first mixer is a fairly expensive replacement. For that reason, of that vulnerability, let me drop. Nowadays, in almost all spectrum analyzers are computer controlled. There's a microprocessor in there. The spectrum analyzer wakes up with the step attenuator in the 10 dB mode. You have to go through a whole rigmarole procedure to force it into the 0 dB mode, and they give you a lot of warnings when you do that. Once there's a 10 dB step attenuator in there, you've got to do something very foolish to now damage that first mixer. But when you've got that directly connected, like you used to be able to do in the manual spectrum analyzers, you'd be amazed how many people would blow that first mixer. In many cases, that was a $200 repair. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yeah, I often wondered, Dick, why they didn't make that a module that plugs in from the front so you could just get another one and plug it in, because it's happened so many times. And I have bought a couple of used ones that had blown front ends, and not easy to fix. And like I said, not cheap. But I thought you'd enjoy those pictures. But I'll send you stuff when I'm working on things and let you get a view of what's happening. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, fun stuff.
By the way, Dick, hold on a second.
Go ahead.
Did you ever look at the Magna Viewer that I sent you Did you look at magnets with that by any chance yet?
I sure have. You mailed me a nice big sheet. I had a small one that I bought a few months earlier. And so when you hold a magnet near it, and you have light coming through it, yes, it does visualization. What I did with my small piece when I bought it a few months ago is I brought it into the laboratory, and they had a very fancy, very high-power microscope. And I looked at the actual grains of material that's in that magnet viewer. What's your guess as to how it does that visualization of a magnetic field? Over to you, John.
I assume it's like the grains of wheat that can be polarized. I don't think they're suspended in liquid, obviously, the way it is in there, but I don't have any idea how the actual mechanical element is taking place. But it sure is interesting. But I was going to suggest, if you had bar magnets, to set them parallel, let them come together, and then offset them by a quarter of an inch, and then look at the pattern at the very end and see the complicated pattern that interference between the two magnetic fields. I don't know if you've noticed that. On that large one, I could see it easily. On the smaller ones, it wasn't as visible.
I'm going to have to think if I've got a couple of bar magnets in the house. When you use a very high power microscope on that green visualization material, magnetic field visualization material, what do you see? You see a whole lot of extremely microscopic bubbles. Inside of each bubble, there is a fluid. Inside of each bubble with the fluid, there is a small little whisker of something that's magnetic, something like steel wool. You know the way you could take steel wool, cut it up very fine with a pair of scissors, and then sprinkle it over a piece of paper that's on top of a magnet, and you'll get a view of the magnetic field. Microscopically, that's what that thing is doing. There really is, the best I can view, a fluid inside of every one of those bubbles and a little whisker of steel inside of every one of those bubbles. And the steel itself, depending on the direction of the magnetic field, you're looking at each one of those whiskers side view, and they give you a big reflection or a big shadow, or you're looking at them end view, and therefore the light shines through differently. So they are microscopic metal filings in a fluid medium in a zillion little extremely microscopic bubbles. That was my impression of what I saw through a microscope. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, then it must be a type of like bubble wrap sandwiched between two laminates, but microscopically. Very interesting. I didn't think there was a liquid in there, but I couldn't understand how these things could be turning around and moving. A wonderful invention. I use it a lot in different things. I'm trying to use it in photography right now, shooting through it, looking at different light sources with magnetic cylinders moving around at the edges. So it's making some wild patterns.
Sounds like you're about to make a psychedelic movie. I sure wish there was a way that they could change the color. Right now it changes opacity. It goes from very, very dark green to a much lighter green, depending on the direction of the magnetic field. And you get the best view where the magnetic field is in transition from north toward south. Pure north or pure south, it all looks the same, so to speak. But it's the transitions that it really views very nicely. Okay, do you think you should go first or Wes should go first on Wes's material? Over to you first, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. No, I think I've occupied enough of the time to let Wesley go. I know he emailed you something, which is two emails, I believe it was. The second one, the revision one, is the one he would want you to look at. And I think that's what we're going to be discussing or trying to find out how it works. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I've gone to his most recent email. I've gone to item number one. I'm opening that right now. Looks like it's 69... megabytes? No. Yeah. It doesn't tell me how many. It's taken a while to load, but I'm soon going to see what it is. think it's labeled 700 kilovolts.
Yes, open the first item that's on there. Just double-click on that, and you'll go to the page with some schematics on it. There's a basic schematic, for, three basic schematics, one on top of another, and then there's a larger schematic below that. So I think that's what he's going to want to talk about.
I see those three schematics with what looks like a power pass transistor set up, a pass transistor and a shunt transistor. And I presume those properly fired generate waveforms. Is that true? N2XJN, K2RIW?
Yeah, N2XJN. Okay. But at first, we have discussed you should have on the first link. Let me reopen the first link. Okay, hold on. Design and operation of 700 kilowatt, kilowatt arbitrary waveform generator.
Yeah, this is called Rev 1 Subjects for TechNet. Arbitrary waveform generator, 700 kilovolt HV pulse based on applied energetic concept. And that item on number one, item A, I guess it is what I just opened up, and I'm, that's what I'm looking at. Over to you, Wes.
Okay, now. It says applied energetics design and operation of 700 kilowatts, kilovolts arbitrary waveform generator. But the major problem that I have with the Glenn's transformer is that Glenn's transformer has the ratio of 1 to 10, and it's supposed to deliver 1,000 volts into that from arbitrary waveform generator, actually function generator. In order for me to find out all of the properties of the carousel's experimental device. We discussed that briefly, and we did go nowhere at that point because you didn't understand how it works. Now, this material that I was able to find, actually, Ida's probably the one that helped me to find it, is not only showing the schematic that we had in question, but it is showing also on second page, on left-hand side, the electrical ground of unit is named, the mechanical structure of it, but on right-hand side, it is showing the schematic of it. I also sent that to Glenn. I wonder if Glenn is here with us, Glenn.
Listening, KC2QIQ.
N2XGN. Now, after digging for 2 months for arbitrary waveform generator of the high voltage, I found there is a hole, a big hole. There is nothing on the market, absolutely nothing. I went through various numbers of sources, and as you see, that email was very much carefully prepared. All of the information related, I was trying to keep in order everything. I would like John to explain a little bit about it better. Remember that we look at the first page on the right-hand side as a photographic drawing, and it does have a two field effect, FED, transistors. Each one is drive by FO gate, which is a arbitrary gate from the waveform generator, the small power one. And I was thinking how it works. I was trying to explain also that capacitor C1, C2, and C3 are not a capacitor. They have made a very clever design. They have made the stages, which each one is the stage, and the stages are truly independent, so the voltage of the individual stage device never increases due to the action of the other device. And this, in contrast to the action of the switching, in serious IGBT, which is a typical transistor of the high voltage with isolated gate, or actually base. I believe John would be able to start it better before I go further. Now, what is important here is right-hand side picture schematic, left-hand side mechanical structure, right-hand side accurate schematic on it, ladies and gentlemen. On the page number 2. And then on page number 3, you're going to see something that is humongous. It's a few tons structure, taller than a person, which shows how that arbitrary waveform generator looks like. It's a humongous structure. And then on page number 4, you see a design with a scope shot of any form that you wish to have. All I need is eventually to understand how the schematic on page 2 or 4 works and make something of myself like that. I mean, it looks like a piece of cake. It looks like a very, very much not a complicated structure. I also added a number of leaks related and explaining how it works, but then first I would ask John to give you a little bit more light about it.
Let me ask a very basic question first. When I look at figure number 1 on page number 1, I'm looking at 3 stages of a kind of a high voltage controlling circuit. A FO gate is feeding the shunt and series transistors. Figure number 2 is some kind of a mechanical assembly of things like that.
That's the capacitor. That's the C capacitor. They call it C or CN. C1, C2, and C3 from the right first page picture schematic. That's the capacitor. Back to you.
Okay, figure number 2 talks about platter of 20 units pulse generators, secondary coils, primary coil, oil enclosure, and so on. High voltage electrode is what it says. In the case of figure number 3, the schematic diagram, is any of the elements of figure number 1 contained somewhere in the schematic diagram of figure number 3?
Here's how it is. They have used 2 coils. One is internal coils, one is external coils. Now, the internal, and they talk also about the rings that, I'm going to read that. We developed a novel means, it says, page number 1 at the end of the abstract. It says, we developed a novel means of charging the stages using air core magnetic flux. We place the stages inside rings, which have a secondary coils on them. We arrange outside the rings and we, with adequate spacing, to have a preliminary coil, primary coil, which provides a time-varying axial magnetic field. The individual stages are charged with voltage multipliers connected to secondaries, coupled to the magnetic field. In this paper, we describe successful construction and operation of one of the devices up to 720 kilovolts. Now, the operation is up to 50 kilohertz, but I found also, and I give you other links, Tanik, that this transistor IGBT could work up to 300 kilohertz, which would be plenty for me to work with. And that they give also in page number 1 at the end of it basic technology concept and explain how it works. So what I understand from that, inside the rings, actually, they put the small electronics inside. Other links will give you a photograph of how it works also, but I believe maybe John has something to add before we ask you and Glenn to give us a helping hand. John.
Yeah, I'm still a little bit confused in that the schematic diagram of figure number 1 it looks to me like it's a basic unit that's somehow going to be duplicated many times, a step and repeat function. Therefore, I expected to see it in figure number 3, schematic diagram. And I don't see that or even a black box representation of that. So my first question is there a relationship between figure number 1 and figure number 3?
Yes.
Go ahead, John.
Figure number 1, there's 3 of them. They're stacked for voltage, just like you would stack batteries. That's the only reason there's 3 of them. If you go to diagram number 3, that is one of those incomplete, showing voltage multipliers plus the switching arrangement. So that's when you look at 3, you will see the series transistor, turn-on transistor, and then the shunt transistor, which is the pull-down transistor. And that's driven by that little FOR. Now, I think that's frequency oscillator, and that should be an A because it's an arbitrary generator, so he can get any kind of waveform he wants. Forget about all those coils and the oil and all that. That's for that device that was working at 375,000 volts or 750,000 volts. Now, the important part is, Dick, I think if you look at this diagram, number 3, on the left, you're going to see the input transformer, the secondary of that transformer. From what I understand, it's driven from each generator. That's where they get the initial signal. You see the voltage doubling that takes place with the diode. That's fed in. Then you're going to see two other iron core inductors. That's all part of that first primary transformer. That's what I believe. They're not showing you that, but they're not labeled. It's another poor diagram. But then you'll notice there's a lot of thinner diodes at the output, and you've got some other rectifiers in there. If you look at that circuit, I'm sure you can figure out how that works. But the number 1 diagram does not have the voltage doublers or all those rectifiers. It's just a simple switching.
So for me, the schematic looks like pretty simple. I mean, if I understand properly how it works, one of the questions that John was asking me, why did it put chain of the diodes on the right-hand side of the figure 3, which are Zener diodes? So that would be one of the questions. But actually, all I need, 1,000 volts or 10,000 volts, if I would be able to deliver myself not the generator, but an amplifier that would give me 10,000 volts, that would be beautiful, and it will not distort the waveform. Or 1,000 volts, because then I could use the fluke. Fluke problem is of matching impedance. I'm playing right now with matching network, but John can tell you a little bit more about it.
Stay on target.
Now, what I recognize in figure number 3, the far left-hand side is a kind of Cockcroft-Walton, I think it's called, high-voltage generator. It's a half-wave voltage multiplier assembly, which, by the way, is giving you a very strong negative voltage at the top, a very strong positive voltage at the bottom. If I've got it correct, let me see. Ooh. Why in the world are the diodes in the same direction on top and bottom? Or are they?
Hey, Dick. Want me to explain the circuit for you?
Multiplier are up and down the ladder, and they are in the same direction.
Dick Glenn has some answers, I think.
I reversed my answer. Highly negative on top, highly positive on the bottom, from that voltage, half-wave voltage multiplier assembly on the far left. There's another one in the upper right-hand corner of the schematic figure number 3. And the FOR could be frequency, oscillation, reference, as a guess. And the so-called FORs look to me like they might be the isolation transformers that Glenn has been describing to us. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Do you mind if I break this down in small chunks for you guys?
Fire away.
Okay, starting at figure 3, going to the left-hand side of the drawing, figure 3, there's a transformer winding. If you notice, there's some capacitive coupling between the transformer winding, and then what you see after that is a rectifier. That's a voltage multiplier rectifier. Does everybody see that so far? So that as that AC waveform swings from that transformer through those capacitive couplings, hits those rectifier diodes, and actually that rectifier will step up the voltage. Has everybody followed that so far?
There are two, and I think that's a so-called Cockcroft-Walton high voltage generator assembly, voltage multiplier generator assembly. Highly negative on top, highly positive on the bottom. Sound correct to you? That could easily make quite a few kilovolts. Over to you, Glenn.
Yes, it is. And notice also that that transformer is completely isolated.
The secondary winding looks like it's completely floating. One lead of it, though, is going to the middle of that assembly, but it's all isolated by way of capacitors. You say it's floating. I think the winding of that transformer, let me make a guess here. If the negative voltage on top was negative 1,000 and the positive voltage on the bottom was positive 1,000, that transformer is at 0 volts with reference to Earth. Over to you, Glenn.
Do you see Earth anywhere in that drawing?
No, I don't, but the winding of that transformer is halfway between the maximum positive and the maximum negative. That winding is sitting halfway between whatever voltage that whole assembly generates.
Yes, it is. The halfway point, and then everything that gets rectified halfway to the plus, to the very, very top is minus, and everything from halfway to the bottom is plus. Do you see that? And there's no ground anywhere in this other than it just says ground on the bottom. But basically, that whole thing basically is a floating winding in space. Do you follow me so far?
I sure do. And because that's a floating winding fed with a transformer, and if this is one stage of a 10-stage thing, each one of them has its own locally generated voltage, and they can all be cascaded as long as there's enough insulation on those secondary windings. If you made 10 of these stages cascaded, then the ones on the end better have a lot of insulation on that secondary winding of those transformers. Back to you, Glenn.
Okay, so that explains that. Now what I'm going to say is let's go up to the top of the page and let's go to back to figure 1. If you look at figure 1, C1 is that whole network that we just saw down there of that isolated winding and those diodes plus and minus. So the minus is basically can be connected towards the bottom and the plus towards the top. Do you follow that one so far?
I'm going to make sure that I understand it properly.
Wait one moment, please, Wesley.
Two capacitors which are DC decoupling or isolating. The diodes on the top, ladder, and diodes on the bottom, ladder. This is a C1.
It is.
However, it's upside down. In the case of figure number 1, positive is on the upper end of C1, negative is on the lower end of C1, yet that multiplier network is upside down. So they've done a little bit of a flip here, Glenn. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do, but I don't want to get involved in the details yet. Let's keep on moving, okay?
Go for it.
Now, they're a little in... Now back on figure 3 again, there's a device in there called FOR. Now, there's an FOR connected to one side on the top and then one on the bottom. Do you see that?
I sure do. I assume that was a kind of a driver transformer for those individual gates. Go ahead.
Well, it's definitely an isolated driver, and that typically is a symbol for a fiber optic connection. So basically what those little sections there are is that there's some kind of a fiber optic cable that has very, very high DC isolation, but you can basically fire pulses down the fiber optic cable and have very, very high isolation into those little figures, and then it generates the voltage on the other side into that 44-20-23, which looks like a ISO driver.
I assume that that was an op amp. Each one of the FORs, and it's got a little bit of a dot on it also showing polarity, there's two tang-like objects on the left-hand side of the bottom one, on the right-hand side of the upper one. Are those two fiber optic cables, like one is a positive going, one's a negative going pulse coming in by way of fiber optic into the FORs? Go ahead, Glenn.
Yes, absolutely, and they have to be, because if you look at the timing difference between when you want the top side to be on and when the shunt side or the bottom side to be on, they have to be basically completely out of phase from each other. Those two cannot be on at the same time. So one basically has to charge to turn it on, the other one has to be turned on to charge to turn it off.
Okay. Could the 4429 be an op-amp? It looks like it might be, or a inverter gate, a logic inverter type thing.
Typically what that looks like to me, Dick, is an isolated, like a fiber optic isolated driver. So in other words, the cable comes in, the fiber optic signal comes in, and that basically converts the fiber optic signal into a prepared voltage. If you notice, there's a biasing power supply winding underneath the bottom that's giving you basically like auxiliary power to power that little driver. So because in other words, there's no power coming through the FOR from the fiber optic. So basically you need another winding to supply the auxiliary power to power the fiber optic driver. Do you see that?
Okay, so I understand there's a transformer isolating the transformers on the top and the bottom for each one of the modules, two of them. Those are the transformers delivering the power for fiber optics?
Oh, the figure number three is one single module. However, the upper half right-hand side, lower half right-hand side, has a separate rectifier network making the voltage that fires each one of those 4429s and the FOR. So in other words, this thing has completely floating power supplies everywhere. Everything floats. Therefore, as long as you've got enough standoff voltage on your secondary windings of those transformers, in theory, you can stack these things to as high as you like. Is that the way you see it, Glenn? Go ahead.
That's basically what I'm seeing there. Now, if we go back up to the top again, back up to figure one, and we look at basically what's going on. What is Q1A? Q1A on the top is basically that top transistor, and then Q1B is the shunt transistor on the bottom. So now when we go back to the other drawing, that's why it's upside down, because if you look at the position of the transistors where the collector and the emitters are for the current flow, now the polarity of what they drew over there and their capacitors makes sense. It doesn't exactly follow the schematic diagram on the top because the Q1 is actually in the opposite polarity. Now, do you see that?
Well, I see only one transistor between two modules, which is gate, emitter, collector.
There are two. Take a look at the, if you look at the thick, heavy lines, there's one one transistor there, and then there's another one between the 50-ohm, 2-watt resistor, basically to what they're called in ground in stage N plus 1. N plus 1 meaning redundancy of these stages that are probably in series.
Let's see that. Oh, yeah, I see that, yes. See that on the lower section, on the right-hand side, gate emitter collector, also two thick lines very vertically.
Okay, now look at all the Zener diodes. See all those Zener diodes stacked in series? It looks like there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15, looks like 20 of them. It even says right there, 1N, 5388 VRLs, 20 of them, 20 times, right? What that is go back up to figure 1, that's what they call DZ1D.
I see it.
I see it as well.
Okay, I think what we're all seeing here is we have isolated fiber optic gates for isolation, isolated windings with voltage multiplier rectifiers to create the C1, a very, very elaborate drive circuit with isolated transformer windings just to power the driving circuitry for these, and then they stack all of these in series. Very, very elaborate circuit. Does not look easy to me, and I wouldn't even want to build one myself. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Well, then I have a comment in here. for 1,000 volts or 10,000 volts, I don't have to go with the fiber optic. I can go for the opto isolator. Am I right, Ben, or wrong?
The problem with opto isolators, Wesley, is that they're very, very slow and they don't draw a lot of, you can't drive a lot of current. MOSFETs drive square waves and arbitrary generators. You need a lot of power moving them up and down to drive those gates. But to drive, with an optocoupler, not a very, very easy thing to do. I would suggest probably a transformer coupling and just a pair of like 1.5 kV MOSFETs like we had suggested last week. You can get two power MOSFETs that can be driven from a very, very small drive transformer to drive basically 1,500 volt FETs, KC2, QIQ.
You're not suggesting IGBT to be used?
Well, the IGBT is a very slow device. They have a lot of storage time when you turn them on, and they go into like a saturation to try to turn them back off. It's not that easy. If you don't drive them into saturation, they become very, very highly dissipative. You really want them back more as switches than linear devices. So the IGBTs, unless you've really worked a lot with them, takes a lot of experience, Wesley. The MOSFETs you probably have a lot better chance with.
I think I figured out why there are 20 zeners on top and 20 zeners on the bottom. I'll figure three, Glenn.
Yeah, that should be their voltage protection. They're building them all up in series.
Yeah, but why are the zeners there in the first place? Go ahead.
They're clamping whatever leakage energy is available when those switches turn off into that winding.
Good guess. There's a much more important reason. I'll tell you what it is. Assume I've got 10 of these stages stacked together. I got 10 figure threes sitting on top of each other, very similar to what's going on with figure two. And if the commanding signals of the fiber optics were all perfectly timed and there was no race problem, they would all go into a conduction toward high voltage or low voltage, no sweat. You've now done well. Occasionally, something is going to be slow. And if of the 10 things stacked together, if, let me pick a number, 8 of them fire exactly correctly, but 2 of them fire slow, then in theory, all of the high voltage of the 10 that have, of the 8 that have fired, will be impressed on the 2 that haven't fired yet. And therefore, the peak in peak inverse voltage would go sky high. Those zeners are there to make sure that the maximum voltage across any one stage doesn't go above those zener voltages in the positive direction or the negative direction. They're the catching diodes, very similar to what you and I would do if I have a whole bunch of capacitors in series because I can't get a high enough voltage. Let me drop.
Can I add something to that, though? Because there's something there that you're missing on top of that that's not switching related.
Go ahead.
If you refer back to figure one, you'll see a C1, a C2, and a C3. And as we've noticed before, there was a transformer winding that was attached for C1, C2, and C3, which is really those rectifiers, the windings, and they're all isolated. But they are tied galvanically together through D3, D2, and D1 on the output side. So when you look at that, what's happening is all of those windings now are floating. They're isolated windings. But there's interwinding capacitance between the winding that represents C1, C2, and C3. And what's happening is because they can't all be on the same magnetic layer, not with voltages that high and with that many rectifiers. So what's actually happening there is that whatever leakage inductance there is between those windings is going to be the voltage differential. And like you said, in order to get them to share during the off mode, the only possible way you can do it is to clamp them with the zener diodes. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The clamping you're talking about, is it positive clamping where you get the maximum voltage on the zener, or negative clamping where you get the minimum voltage on the zener? And maybe the answer is both. Over to you, Glenn.
Right on, because you can get the forward conduction in the other direction that prevents it from going minus, and that's what actually, if you notice over there, D2 is actually in parallel to show that function.
D2 does not appear in figure 3.
Yes, but it's describing your Zener function in the forward direction.
1,000 volts in my example. And you got 10 stages connected together. So you're capable of making a 10,000 volt pulse. And if you fire them all synchronously, you go between essentially 0 volts to 10,000 volts when they all fire correctly synchronously on the leading edge and the trailing edge. If any of them fired late, you have the possibility of 9,000 volts appearing across the one stage that didn't fire yet. Without those Zeners, you'd be wiping out that stage. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, absolutely, because the transistors, the reason that they're cascading them or they're putting them all in series like that is because they're trying to limit the voltage on each one of those stages, the three that they're showing. And that's basically just due to the silicon limitations of the voltage on those devices. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
As I see it, this whole schematic, as long as you can make enough standoff voltage capability of the secondary windings of that transformer. There's a total of three transformers in figure three. Three transformers per stage. As long as the windings of the transformer can tolerate the high voltage, there in theory is no limit to the amount of stacking you could do. Stack 10 of these in my example, you get 10 kilovolt pulse. Stack 20 of them, you get a 20 kilovolt pulse. And except for the winding limitation and Mother Nature arcing over the air outside of this thing, other than that, there is no limitation on this thing. You can go as far as you want. What's your best guess as to what's the maximum peak voltage on any one stage? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I think these IGBTs are probably rated somewhere like around, I don't know, you can probably get them to like 1,500 volts, say 1,000 volts a piece, something like that. So theoretically, that could be 3,000, but that's without any derating. But just to give you an idea of probably how many they're stacking, page down a little bit further, and take a look at what they're calling over here, figure number four. And you look at the geometry of that, and that pretty much gives you an idea of the spacings that they're talking about here in order to generate those kinds of kilovolts. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I haven't read enough of this thing yet, but did they say how big a pulse this thing is making and how many stages they're stacking? And by the way, if those IBGTs, if those transistors are good for 1,500 volts max, a conservative design would be 1,000 volts per stage, and now stack as many stages as you need to get as many 1,000 volts you want. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Figure 2 has 13 stages represented. It sounds to me like this thing can make it says platter of 20 unit pulse generators, okay? If each one's good for a kilovolt, I think this is a 20 kilovolt pulse generator. What do you think, Glenn?
And something tells me that the way that this whole thing is working is that there's still another winding in here somewhere. Because if you go all the way back down to the bottom by figure four, and you look at this device at the very bottom, this thing is huge, Dick. Have you looked at that photograph on the bottom?
I'll back up a little bit. I suddenly got a flash of brains to the head. Figure number two, primary coil, is the one primary that feeds the whole darn thing. The secondary coils, each individual stage in the middle of that primary coil, magnetically picks up the voltage from the primary. So each individual stage has its own winding all stacked together. I think I see what's going on here. So in other words, by physical separation in that figure two, in theory, you could go as many stages as you want. What did you just say, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when you look at the bottom, you still have to look at that figure number four, the photograph on the bottom, because they tell you which drivers that they're using over here. In other words, they're using the 4420s and the 4429s as the IGB tree drives. And then when you take a look at the very, very bottom, they show you right now this whole setup is for 250 kV to 750 on the output, and then they show a photograph. I was just wondering, have you been able to get to figure four and see the photograph?
I have. By the way, each of those things that look like an op amp, both of them, when you blow it up big enough, are a 4429. They're identical. And yes, I've seen that. And the bottom picture, what I think I'm seeing on figure number four when I look at, oh my, there it is, the outer white cylinder at the bottom, it's just the outer shield, just above the upper surface of the lower white outer shield, I think I'm seeing the primary winding. I'm seeing about four turns of the primary winding. And you're not seeing the secondary windings inside, but I think we're seeing the primary winding with a great big metal plate on the top of that second cylinder inside. Is that approximately what you're seeing, Glenn?
Yeah, and basically what I'm seeing there is that the secondary winding, and there's the probe, is all the way up on top. If you look at that it looks like maybe like at least a 1 foot in diameter pipe coming out the top, and then it's got like an L section coming off of it. That's probably the secondary high voltage probe coming off of the secondary winding at 730 kilovolts.
They do not touch.
Yeah, I think that probe at the top is the pulse output, Glenn. I think the bottom of the circuit gets grounded to earth. That L-shaped probe on the top is the pulse power output, in my opinion. Now, Glenn, go ahead. And by the way, I think they made it that large in diameter to make sure there's no local corona.
No corona, no sparking, no arcing, and I think we just described the circuit, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ, back to you.
But we're fairly sure now that this whole thing is a 700 kilovolt pulse generator made out of 20 stages. That would imply that each individual stage is 1/20th of 700, which is a little less than a kilovolt, I think.
Okay, now, if you could go, guys, to skip point number one completely, because we could talk about it, but we have limited time. Point number two, the first link, which is A. Point number two says various high voltage switching networks. Point number A, MOSFET switch block diagram, and click on that one.
Hey, Glenn, when I divide 20 into 700 kilovolts, I get 35. Are we going to say that each individual stage can tolerate 35 kilovolts? Something's wrong.
I don't think that they described it properly there, but I think what's still happening, Dick, is that there's still a transformer winding in between. So in other words, that is basically, in other words, because there's no, like, 30 kV MOSFET. You know, I mean, they're 1 kV MOSFETs, but... even in the biggest blocks, but realistically, I think what we're looking at there is that there's still another primary secondary winding, so that's still probably those driver windings in the fiber optics were probably just driving those kilovolt modules, and those kilovolt modules were probably still driving a transformer.
JB, you believe there's another step-up transformer that's not shown. So each module, we are guessing, is close to a kilovolt. 20 of them means that the raw pulse out of the 20 modules is a 20 kilovolt pulse. And I guess you're saying there's another, let me think now, 20 times 10, there's another 15 to 1 ratio, wait a minute now, 20 into 70. Huh.
35.
There's a 35 to 1 step-up transformer that makes 20 kilovolts into 700 kilovolts, and that's not shown? Is that what you're saying?
I think it's sort of implied there. In other words, when you look at that buildup of windings, in other words, they show you in figure, I think it was figure two, they basically kind of show like a stacking, and basically what it looks like right there is that whole thing is basically driving, in other words, it's called a driver, so it looks what it's doing is it's probably driving a primary winding of a 35 to 1 ratio.
Take a look at the top of figure two. That circle at the top of figure two says high voltage electrode. That is that round L-shaped object, Glenn.
Yeah, but I don't think that it's being directly connected to those MOSFETs directly. I'm not sure. As I said, I'm not sure exactly of everything that they're showing there. You know, I think we have like maybe 90% comprehension here, but not full 100%. We might need the actual author here to tell us everything on this one.
Okay, the right-hand side of figure 2 does say 20-unit pulse generators. Unit pulse generator. Is figure number 3 a unit pulse generator?
Well, then look at it this way. You'd need at least 20 of them, right, or another 35 of them in order to get to 750 kV.
I just found something. Look at figure number 3. Look at the label. The right-hand label of figure number 3 says schematic of one stage of the 220 stages.
There we go. Now it explains it.
It probably costs like millions of dollars.
Why does figure 3 say 220 stages? Figure 2 says platter of 20-unit pulse generators. The numbers are not quite right, but at least we're getting close.
But that would explain how you can use an IGBT there, you know, with like a kilovolt rating. Because then, you know, the numbers fall into place. But that's how it could be done.
If each one of those IGBT transistors is good for a kilovolt, and you got 220 of those stages, I got 220 kilovolts. I'm still missing by 2 to 1 on 700 kilovolts.
Yeah, it's still confusing. I'm not sure that everything here is 100% in this article. They're really telling us everything here.
Now, Wes, you intend to make a pulse of how many kilovolts? Because if this is the stage that you are thinking of building, and now discussing how many of these stages. Before we go there, the actual transistors that are used in figure number 3, I'd like to believe that those transistors are not huge in price. What do you think, Glenn?
No, they are 40 something dollars, but they are slow. I'm dropping this idea. It's simply not worth the effort. All I'm looking for is either something that gives me a perfect match from Monster, which is the Fluke 5205A, to Glenn's transformer. The second option is another transformer that will be ratio 1 to 100 that will not disturb the signal and be connected to the Glenn's transformer, but will give me a perfect matching of the output of Fluke. Another option...
The time is 12 o'clock a.m.
is go to the link that I mentioned to you, which is in point number 2A, and click the first link. And this is something very much simple to be done and to execute.
Can I just interject here for a minute, Wesley?
Well, would you please?
Last week, I think we mentioned this already, that there is, you know, 1500 volt power MOSFETs, N channels, you know, I think, what do they call the 13N150s or 13N15s. And if you look up those, you can get them in Mauser for like, you know, $10 a piece. And all you need is two. And stack them, you know, on there and get a very, very small audio drive transformer with two isolated windings on it, and you should be good to go.
So, for me, the best way is just to have a simple example of the schematic, and I can build something like that. That's why I really would like to ask you to go to that point. And is that what you're thinking about? It sounds very much simple. It's point number 2A. Firstly.
Yeah, when you open up 2A, you get this beautiful picture of a... have I got the right one here?
A first link is being... It's two various high voltage networks, and there is A underneath. It says MOSFET switch block diagram. And then you click on the first link.
And when you do, you get something called gate drivers are insulated to 12 kilovolts. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4... 5 transistors there, or was it 6? 5 transistors in series. When you open up that 2A diagram of this MOSFET switch block diagram, each one